Art Slice is a different dive into art history. We goof around, we curse, you learn from it, but don't expect a typical lecture. You're welcome.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
In 1892, Mary Cassatt received an unexpected commission request delivered to her Parisian studio all the way from Chicago, Illinois, USA, in case you were wondering. The commission was for a massive 58-foot by 14-foot mural for the 1893 World Columbian Exposition, aka the Chicago World's Fair. This was surprising, as Mary had no connection to Chicago, and while she was American, she had spent most of her adult life in France.
And she was basically considered a European Impressionist, whose peak was like well over 10 years ago at this point. Everyone's kind of into post-impressionism now. Oh, God.
¿Qué te dije? ¿Qué te dije? Speaking of now, the commission request was for a vision of the modern woman, which would be nestled along the coved ceiling of the first ever women's building, opposite a mural commissioned by yet another Mary, Mary McMonies, telling the story of the ancient woman.
The golden girl, Stephanie. Beiged, pasteled, permed.
Florida. Together, the murals would speak to women's past accomplishments and future possibilities. Cassatt had long been making work that pointed towards the moral virtue of women's labor, something that she herself experienced daily while laboring in her artist's studio. And this mural offered an opportunity to develop that vision further in more didactic ways by exploring the story of a woman whose labor brought life and knowledge into this world, Eve. Cassatt envisioned a scene both past and forward-looking, a reimagining of that biblical tale. Women plucking fruit from the tree of knowledge, not to undo humanity, but to empower it. With her vision clear, Mary did not hesitate to say yes.
She did, though. She did hesitate to say yes.
Yeah, okay, yes. She did. Absolutely, yes. For a lot of very good reasons.
Like we said, living in France, where the hell was she going to paint this giant mural? That's point number two. And secondly, point number three, thirdly, how the hell was she going to get this thing to Chicago?
Right, logistically.
Yeah, what was it, 58 by 14 foot? Yeah. Something like that? Was she going to roll it up?
That's a big boat.
That's a big boat.
But when she heard Edgar Degas, her best and worst friend's hater-ass reaction, proclaiming mural work as decorative, as an art that is not arting enough, she thought, you know what? I can make this work.
So it's a spite mural, is what you're telling me.
It's a
mural of spite.
Mostly for it was for women, but yes, also probably a little bit of spite. Welcome to Art Spite, a show about art by two artists, myself, Stephanie Duenas, and my partner, Russell Shoemaker.
We're both filled with spite and vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of our thing here.
Flavorful.
Yeah, bubbles up. It's good. It's good for the
gut.
Thank you.
And the brain. You're welcome. Listeners, today we are possibly foolishly talking about the only mural Mary Cassatt ever made.
Possibly foolishly because it's a work we have never before ever seen in person, mostly because it's gone. It no longer exists. It was lost to the sands of time, and we only have a couple, I think two, grainy black and white photographs to go off of.
And it's fine. It's fine. We're going to do our best. We will do our best. We're going to make it work.
Sorry. Hang in there with us, listeners.
Hang in there with us, yeah. Listeners. Now, this mural came up in our talk last fall with Emily A. Beeney, the chief curator at the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco, about the excellent Mary Cassatt at Work exhibition. You can actually check that out here. And like we mentioned in that episode, Mary Cassatt is an artist that I slept on because at first glance, and I don't mean this in like a derogatory way at all, but her work kind of comes across upon first glance completely unrelatable to me, like a little bit B for boring.
Her most well-known work has a lot of barriers of entry. I think for me, I think for you. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of women with children, with little babies. And I'm a man in a t-shirt,
right, I guess,
with no children.
For me, it's just, I just see all of those wealthy women with the babies. And I'm just like, I cannot relate to this because it's a lot of babies.
Yeah, I mean, but she is an excellent painter. Like mm-hmm. I said yep. in our interview, I think she's goated. Like Degas, very much pushing the boundaries of art, even pushing like the boundaries of Impressionism.
Mm-hmm.
Like we have this piece in our local museum, which is just like, it's just a portrait of a girl, just a little girl in a little bonnet, I think. But the way it breaks apart into brushstrokes and then reaccumulates into a portrait isn't like too far off from like a Jenny Saville or even like a Cecily Brown.
Yeah.
Where like the strokes loosen into slashed on topographical map moments mm-hmm. and solidify back into solid matter in other moments.
Right.
Mary wouldn't be seen as radical as those artists today. Before that time, she was incredibly radical.
Right. And this mural was a challenge even for her, known as an impressionist, now suddenly serving up something totally different
yeah.
that, as we will see, this was a challenge for the public to chew on. We're actually going to start from the beginning.
And this is going to require a little bit of a mind excavation, if you will, Stephanie. Not sure that segue works, but to help us do that, Magic Mind, once again, we mentioned them in our last two episodes. They've been coming in clutch for us.
And Magic Mind has amino acids like L-theanine, naturally derived from ceremonial grade matcha, got lion's mane, ashwagandha, rhodiola, among other synergistic. I can't say this word.
Synergistic.
How about you just take over?
Synergistic.
Okay. Synergistic ingredients. All science-backed, and we've been actually taking them before we record with a little bit of café. And if you couldn't tell, we are both pretty neurodivergent, and this helps us rein it in a bit.
All in these like little 2-ounce bottles. So I'm realizing we need to get some because we have a kind of a big trip coming up.
Big trip.
So we're going to need to be calm. We're going to need to be chill. We're going to need to have that Zen energy,
yes,
you know,
yes.
Zen energy.
You can use ArtSlice20 as a discount code for 20 to 48% off. That helps us out, and hopefully it will help you out as well. Okay, let's get into Mary Cassatt. Mary Stevenson Cassatt was born in 1844 in Allegheny, Pennsylvania, now part of Pittsburgh, north of the Allegheny River, but nowhere near the Allegheny Mountains, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so pull out your mental atlas of Pennsylvania, dear listeners. Mostly, you're going to find it's mostly a turnpike-based society. So you're going to travel along the roads past the Amish goods stand at the Travel Plaza, pick up some jelly. Do yourself a favor. Do something good for yourself today.
Okay.
Pick up some jelly, some Amish jelly.
All right.
Past the dilapidated Ruby Tuesdays in the old Kmart parking lot, kitty corner, catty corner, to the BP with the Dunkin' Donuts drive-thru. If you see the guy hanging out in the old Cordell Stewart jersey, you'll know you're at the right BP and you at the right Dunkin' and you have about, you know, like 40-ish miles to go.
Mary was the fourth of five kids born. They were considered middle class in the Gilded Age, which was not what we consider middle class today, which meant that they were very wealthy.
In the Gilded Age, there were the supremely wealthy, known as the Upper Tens, basically the billionaire overlords of the 19th century, and the robber barons who worked for them. And they had the whole world, the whole wide American world in their pockets, the government in their pockets, something we here in big, beautiful America are speed running back towards today.
Palantir, Meta, Google,
exactly.
Elon.
Yeah, exactly. But these were the J.P. Morgies, the Vanderbilts, the Rockefellers. But at least, you know, unlike Palantir and Google and Meta, they made tangible things, not just vaporware that they pushed off to investors and just kind of like secured money on top. Anyway. The Cassatts, for example, had built up a nice portfolio for themselves while working and banking directly from the hands of Daddy Carnegie's booming steel industry.
But they still had to work, and they had to work hard.
And we don't have time to get into the weeds as to the reason why all this was happening, but basically it instilled a sort of like wealth paranoia in them, also known as the Protestant work ethic.
Everyone else, though, had it way worse. No labor rights for anyone, so many gradations of awful based on your class, gender, and color. Bad for most, but not bad for Mary, but also not great because she was still a woman, a second-class citizen.
Below the upper tens, below the middle class, were like the middle-class ladies.
Right.
The gals.
Despite this Protestant work ethic paranoia, the Cassatts were incredibly privileged. Mary would spend her early life between Philadelphia, London, Paris, and Berlin. She was given a world-class education, becoming multilingual, being exposed to other ways of life, and thanks to spending time in Paris, where she would have seen the bestest French painters of the day, she became a good slow art looker. And that art dopamine parasite burrowed its way into her little brain, leaving an impression on her.
Whether Paris or PA, Mary grew up in a time where the status quo was all things like romantic hyper-realism. In the U.S., we're coming out of an era that favored art like that of the Hudson River School painters, selling paintings that kind of sold a vision, a kind of manifest destiny poster on your wall of ever-expanding natural resources, perfect for the age of pilfering said natural resources. Europe was just a different flavor of this. Paris leaned on centuries-long art institutions like the Salon to determine the artistic pursuits that were deemed worthwhile, prizing artists' skills in rendering. But without those vast, untapped lands to highlight, portraiture and grand narratives were preferred. Mm-hmm. But both in America and Europe, innovation was about to change.
Tin tubes.
Tin tubes filled with oil paint allowed for a wide spectrum of readily available, transportable, and vibrant color. All of a sudden, artists could spend more time painting outdoors, and a group of young European painters, all born around the same time as Mary, were like, you know what? Spending a day outside, soaking up that vitamin D, capturing color as quickly as we see it, sounds way better. Yep. In fact, so much better than spending weeks upon weeks inside some dusty studio leering at a model expelling their bad air.
Sit down air.
While capturing the fleeting moments of a world that was changing as quickly as they painted it, a sort of like looseness with the paint strokes developed, a quickness with capturing the changing light, and a whole variety of possible subjects beyond those studio walls became available. But all of this was way too rad for those trad art institutions. I'm looking at you, Salon.
Too tubular.
Tubular. Totally tube.
Yeah, because tin tubes.
I got it.
Totally tubular.
Totally tubular. You're right. No notes. You're right.
While these young artists slowly evolved into what would become the Impressionists, they tried to play by the art institutional tastemaker's rules, the Salon.
But more often than not, they were rejected, of course. And in Manet's case, even panned by some incredulous, like, comic book nerd, okay, who made fun of his art style. Really rude. Really panned. Rude and uncalled for. But who, you know, who's laughing now? Because Manet's, you know, he's much more well-known.
Yeah, what's his name?
Horribly?
His name?
I don't know. Yeah, exactly. But thankfully, enter the bitchy, incel, troll-like character and Mary's future unlikely frenemy, and the Impressionist's greatest champion, Edgar Degas.
But, car screech, back to Mary, 15 to 20 years pre-Ed, while all of those educational and life experiences Mary was afforded by her family were progressive for the time, it was there to serve an end goal to make Mary a suitable wife for a wealthy caller.
Kind of an Eve to an Adam, you might say.
Yeah, you might. So not just to become a unique individual with hopes, dreams, and passions. However, what Mary developed as a result of all of those life experiences was kind of edge. Okay.
And kind of got the apple grabbies. She got a good case of the apple grabbies.
Sticky fingers.
Yeah. Sticky fingers for apples.
So the apple grabbies and the edge began to boost her confidence as she matured, which was something she was going to need to swim upstream as a woman in the 19th century. When Mary Cassatt was 16 in 1860, she convinced her family to let her attend the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts, the first art museum and art school in the United States. Half of her the time was progressive, maybe. At least they knew that ignoring half of the population wasn't growth mindset enough because they allowed women to attend. Under the condition that they were not allowed to draw from life, only studies of other paintings or from sculptures.
Okay.
And if the sculptures happened to be naked, if, say, there was some sort of sculptured weenie in the room.
Yeah, don't guess on Los Guinis.
Is there a weenie in the room? Yeah. Is it present with
us? Don't miss on Los Queenies.
But why, Stephanie?
Why, Stephanie?
You just said PAFA was progressive. Besides the moral implications of a woman drawing a Queenie, the women's pursuit of art was not seen as serious during this time. Career wasn't a word that dared be uttered.
Okay, so what do they do when they saw, like, David?
They didn't.
Just like, hanging over you. Like, do they put the fig leaves, like, in front of their faces when they go into the...
That's the censor instead of
someone, like, holding, like, you know, one of those, like, light reflective things they have in photo shoots, just, like, following the women around so they can see the Queenie?
A chaperone for the eyes?
Yeah,
I don't know. Yeah. That's a great question.
You know, there's a lot of hate for the smallness of David's little Queenie.
There is. That,
but if you think about the size of the sculpture, I would think if you had like a regular sized, not saying, look, no hate, like a normal sized like Queenie situation there would be towering over you.
Well, that's just dangerous.
You got to think about perspective too. You know what I mean? You got to think about the perspective of someone walking into the place. Like maybe they had to scale down the Queenie to allow... for like a normal interpretation of the Queenie. I feel like everyone's just looking on it like head on, like a photograph, and really need to think about like what it's going to be like if you're looking up, peering out, you know, it over top of you.
All great questions.
Okay.
All great things to be considered. It sounds like you spent a lot of time thinking about this.
Yeah. It's important things to think about as a man.
Back to women in the 1860s.
It's not small. This is your perspective.
You were in the pool.
I was in the pool.
He was in the pool. All right. Back to women in the 1860s on the East Coast of the USA. Mm-hmm. Career was not a word that dared be uttered by young middle class women.
Yeah.
And let alone art and career said together in the same sentence.
Yeah.
Okay. Their families sent them there to schools to build their wife CV, 19th century edition, right?
Wife. Yeah, sure.
Hand it to the wealthy husband to be. So what are we going to find on that CV? We're going to find sewing, crocheting, little painting, right? All fun stuff. And you're probably wondering, Stephanie, what about the other stuff? Well, the other stuff, the three C's, cooking, cleaning, child rearing, that would all be taken care of by the governesses, the wet nurses, the hired help.
Right. This is a real train to be an upper class lay, well, I guess middle class layabout sort of situation. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So your husband can kind of quip during a dinner party that Margaret, while no Thomas Cole, was once quite gifted with the horsehair brush.
Oh, Samuel.
And that's how I knew she was worthy to carry my seed into the
Samuel.
Next
Sorry.
All
you
gender
speak
issues
spoken to. Sorry.
Aside. Thank you. Just the idea of being like confined to lay about the house as a wife in a beautiful mansion cage with like everything being done for me as my body softens as I'm like confined. I feel like I'm confined like some sort of a veal, some sort of a soft human like wife veal.
Jesus, okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Wife veal?
It makes my skin crawl.
I don't know.
Gives me like human veal based anxiety. I don't want to be soft meat is what I'm trying to say. I want to be a soft caged meat.
Those are great goals to have.
Yeah.
Yes. I think she felt maybe some of that pang of anxiety, right?
Anxiety.
Not wanting to become a veal wife, right? She's like, you know what? I'm going to be something gristly. Little harder, little tougher
gristly.
To chew on.
Yeah,
grizzly.
Like that.
Yes,
stringy. Stringy meat.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Stringy.
Exactly. The kind of chew that a normal American would give up on. You know what I mean? He didn't know what he was getting himself into at the Korean barbecue place.
Okay. And Mary didn't want to.
I would like to speak to the manager. The steak is very thin and is unchewable. I cannot chew it. I also regret to inform you the spicy lettuce. The spicy lettuce has turned, ma'am. The spicy lettuce has turned. It's all tingly. It's making my mouth tingly. I can't chew the meat. My mouth is tingly. What am I supposed to do here in this Vietnamese, in this Korean barbecue place? Where's the mustard sauce? Where's the white mustard sauce?
Okay, Mary.
Where's the Dr. Pepper barbecue sauce?
What the fuck?
The Dr. Pepper barbecue sauce.
Is that
it
real?
It says barbecue. Where's the Dr. Pepper barbecue
Jesus.
Sauce?
Okay.
Is it so hard?
Samuel.
Something about burnt
Sam.
Ends.
Sam. Simmer down. Is this the 21st
Sam wants
century?
Burnt ends. All soft burn ends.
Burn his ends. Yeah. Okay, Mary had started to get this crazy idea that she was actually building a real CV, an actual artist portfolio. And she detested the way that PAFA was treating her in such a condescending manner, limiting her potential and devaluing the idea of making, which takes so much work and so much energy, just for it to be relegated as a flippant pursuit of a woman hobbyist.
Yeah.
So she...
Veal.
Yeah, so veal. No, so not veal Mary. So grizzly Mary. Organized the first actual drawing from life class, okay? Mm-hmm. No paintings of paintings here. No paintings of
be-fig
leaf statues. None of that
not
here. No fig leaves to
de-figgled.
Be seen.
She de-figgles.
She's
Figgling.
Yeah, once you get a little bit of that gristle, that veal toughens up a little bit, the veal meat toughens up a little bit, you're going to be defiggling some stuff.
She's defiggling the patriarchy.
You're going to have the forearm strength to defiggle.
Okay. All right. So the ladies who attended this drawing from life class would draw each other with clothes on.
Okay.
Clothes on, because also this is the 19th century. They have a million layers on. They really couldn't take any of it off. Anyway, Mary was buttoned up. Okay. She was real proper, mm-hmm. both in dress and profession. But one can only take so much repression. And her siblings actually reported to their father a shift in her ways. They mm-hmm. were snitches, if
yeah,
you will.
Snitching on her.
That she gotcha. Was a pot boiling over.
Beep. Why do you do this to me? You know, this is a great time to show off our new Art Slice t-shirt. Sorry about the shorts in advance. It is hot in here. It's 90 degrees in here.
Fiddle with this. Look at this. Art Slice t-shirt.
It matches your shorts. It does match the shorts. It is hot in here.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the backside. That's my backside.
And the backside of the t-shirt.
You saw it here first.
Yeah.
Sure.
And that's the orthopedic ball I sit on. So my back doesn't fall
wheel.
Apart, I'm old.
It's a wheel.
Wheel, whatever.
No, ball, it's wheel, not. They're not the same thing at all.
Situation.
Words matter.
Buy our t-shirts. It helps support Art Slice. Thank you.
Yes. Don't you want more of this? Don't you want more of this?
I'll show you more of my backside if you buy a t-shirt. I know that's what everyone's clamoring for.
Okay. All right.
What were we saying?
Beep. But one can only take so much repression. And her siblings started to notice. And they reported a shift in Mary to their father, her father. As if she's a pot boiling over. Okay, she's done. She's donezo. And she goes to her father. She goes to her father and says,
I'm leaving to Paris. To Paris, I am leaving. Goodbye, Papa. Also, give me your money.
Father, I am leaving to Paris. And I will need your checkbook. Thank you.
This whole rejection of life and how it was lived is not only pushing against like those gendered expectations that we were talking about, but it also risks casting a negative light on the Cassatt family as a whole entity, mm-hmm. right? They're already getting those new middle-class money smirks at the older money middle-class country clubs, right? They can't also have a daughter go rogue and become an artist or rouge.
Papa says, thinking of other people and what they would think, honestly, Mary, I know what happens in that filthy town, Paris. Mm.
How do you know, Papa? How do you know about that filthy stuff that happens in that filthy town?
Don't worry about that. Okay. What you need to worry about is that the fact that I would rather you be dead than you go to Paris.
Wow.
Mama Cassatt steps in. She steps in and she's like, Mary can go on the condition that I, Mama, am going to accompany her. Mm. So apparently, and I don't know if this was news to Mary or Mama, but Paris was not even as progressive as Paffa was at this time. Okay. The École des Beaux-Arts, the Paffa of Paris.
Yeah,
at this
time. They'd love to hear us describe it that way.
They would love
the École des Beaux-Arts would love
five
us.
Five stars. They did not allow female students to attend, not even the wealthy ones.
Okay.
No women.
No women.
Okay. The Beaux-Arts is shooing her away with their baguette.
On guard. They're all, yeah, she grabs another one on guard. Exactly. Crumbs everywhere.
Mess.
Pigeons pouring down.
Yep.
Parisian pigeons.
Yes.
The worst of the pigeons.
Vicious. So this was the standard of Paris at this time. Well-to-do women were not allowed in very many places at all. So Mary can't just easily wander around Paris without a chaperone. But Mary would use her social status and her access to do whatever necessary to push back against this misogyny in order to advance this passion for painting into an actual profession. Maybe one of the only places Mary could be unaccompanied was the Louvre, which was a perfect spot for tourists and young meet-cutes.
Yeah, sitting in front of like stuffy portraits and giant paintings of migrants dying on rafts really kindles a 1890s erotic kind of fire in the loins of these teenagers.
It's an R-rated movie, basically.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. All the Guinies, too. A lot of Guinies.
Well, if there's Guinies, she's got to fasten her bonnet a little bit tighter.
Yeah.
Cover those weenies from her view.
It's called a bonnet blinder.
Despite it being looked down upon as the work of tourist hawkers, she applied and was issued a coveted permit to be a copier at the Louvre, not necessarily to sell.
What is a copier?
A copier is someone who copies paintings and then sells them.
Okay.
Mostly to tourists.
But she wasn't selling them.
No.
Okay.
No.
She was flexing her skills.
She was trying. Yes, exactly.
Okay. She's doing master studies.
Exactly.
She can't go to the Beaux de la Arts, whatever it's called.
She cannot.
The Paffa of Paris.
No. She's going to go around.
Okay. Gotcha.
She's going to go around.
She finds some workarounds.
You know what she did?
What?
She researched the École des Beaux-Arts faculty's work mm-hmm. and reached out to those she thought could help her improve problem areas in her paintings.
Okay.
But she's still doing this essentially in secret.
Okay.
Because she couldn't run that far away from that womanly world. And it's here where the work Mary would become known for really starts to make sense, where gender roles, general safety, and baguette-toting gatekeepers pushed her back into that faded life of boredom confined to your family's estates. The world that Mary was so eager to rage against.
Despite all her rage, she's still just a veal in a cage.
Yes. The work ethic and righteous rage that was beginning to boil over in Mary was becoming more and more apparent as Mary herself would become more and more outspoken despite her class and her family name. And those in her family circles were beginning to take notice. Meanwhile, Mary and her PAFA bestie, Eliza Haldeman, rendezvoused in the French countryside. They traveled to Italy and Spain to draw and take in the scenery, studying master paintings of Spanish Diego Velázquez and Bartolomé Esteban Murillo, and the Italian Correggio's fresco murals. While Mary's family was cool with all of this, Eliza's parents, not so much, warning her, quote, "I feel that you and Miss Cassatt may venture too far. Do not rely on her judgment as she has no religion to guide her, and from the impulse of a moment, you may rush into things that may injure you."
Oh, no.
End quote. Eventually, Eliza had to give up painting and go back to Philly to begin her domestic veal life, which was the last thing that Mary wanted for herself.
Mary's family gradually, or begrudgingly, became more supportive of her. Eventually, they were like, okay, it's a career you want, a career you shall receive. We'll make sure that you have food and shelter, but your art is going to have to pay for itself. Mm-hmm. So this was either to nudge Mary to give up on painting or to ignite that Protestant work ethic into her practice. That same Protestant work ethic that had helped the family gain that middle-class fortune. Add this to that not going to be veal fire, and she began to treat her art as like a 9-to-5 or sometimes like a 9-to-9, setting her sights on notoriety and marketability.
At this time, the best way to get your art seen in Paris would be in the salon. The art tastemakers that stood in the way of those young, envelope-pushing, soon-to-become impressionist painters. This yearly exhibition could make or break an artist's career, and because of Paris's art capital status, this held sway not just in Europe, but in the whole West. Mm. As a kiddo learning about the impressionists myself, I thought that they were exhibiting in an actual hair salon.
A hair salon. Mm-hmm. Real hair salon.
Hair salon.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, see it like the old school, like curling glass dome things. I could see that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Below the stacks and stacks and stacks of paintings.
Yes.
Perfect. Yeah.
They wore wigs.
Reader magazines, which were also the paintings above.
I knew that they wore wigs. It just made sense. They need the glass domes to keep their...
To perm their wigs?
Yes. Duh.
They have to sit there? Wig be permed? Anyway.
This is kid logic.
Fine. Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. It makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. Le Salon was run by a bunch of old dudes in wigs, big wigs, and like many institutions at this time, they were just stuck in their ways and would not choose any works that weren't your usual subjects like historical, mythological portraiture and all that painted in a realistic manner.
Mm. We don't want your sausages or your fruits and tablecloths. Okay.
Yeah. Spit on me, please. It's gross. Okay. All right. All right. Which, by the way, if you've ever been like rejected from a juried art exhibition, like don't feel that badly. I mean, it could mean that you need to keep working on your shit, right? That's good to grow from feedback like that, right?
Rejection is protection.
Yeah, rejection is protection. But I like that. That's good.
I stole it from somebody. I'm not even going to take credit for that. Anyway.
But it could also mean that maybe one bewiggled bad apple juror was just really concerned with validating their role on said panel, and the rest of the panel members maybe just kind of eventually were worn down. Not speaking from personal experience, or am I? Wink.
Said portraits had to be so realistically painted as to hide the artist's hand, and they seemed to value the dark and dreary.
Yeah, somber earth tones.
Yes.
I love them.
And
love
to
them.
Finish it all off, they expected a thick amber varnish to kill any little vibrancy that the painting may have still had.
Yeah, yeah, protect their eyes.
Mary wants to fit in, and she wants to get ahead. So her style appeared to mimic the salon's preferences, right? Realistic portraits, mostly of women, because that's what she had access to.
Right.
And in somber earth tone backgrounds.
Yeah.
Just kind of meh.
Yeah.
Well done, but kind of meh.
Yeah, even the sitter here looks like half alive.
Yeah. Yeah. Boring in subject and in execution.
I mean, she's not even strumming that. My God, like get her a coffee. Get this woman a coffee. I don't know if they had coffee
Some
back
water.
Then. Get her something. Something with caffeine in it. A tea. A tea. They like tea there, right? Get her a cigarette. I don't know. Give her some nicotine.
Give her some
Zen. Jesus Christ. Give her something. Give her a Zen.
Someone from the future go back there.
Her eyes are like this. Something. I need her eyes like this. You know what I mean? Like.
After being rejected from the salon several times, Mary is finally accepted at the age of 22 for her work, a mandolin player, making her one of the first American women to be accepted. And as much as we're kind of bashing the salon, this is a huge achievement for Mary.
Yes.
This no-name American woman had made it into the salon. She had sidestepped all of the rules that kept her from becoming an artist, right? She did it. She crossed oceans. She greased palms. She worked her fluffy dress ass off. However, I think there was still just a little bit of caged rage in her. While her achievements were great, they were still within expectations of a rigid institution. So, was this it? Was she just going to keep cranking out these somber-ass paintings of sad women with mandolins?
Or like throwing flowers?
No, don't.
You mustn't.
Please don't.
You mustn't.
She started to speak up about the salon as a necessary evil, not as an achievement that was artistically challenging or rewarding.
She's never happy, this veal. Veal-ass woman, never happy. Just typical woman, never happy.
You know what? That you
get back in your cage. In your mansion cage.
Another American artist friend of Mary's, painter and engraver Emily Sartan, wrote, quote, "She, Mary, is entirely too slashing, snubs all modern art, disdains the salon pictures of Cabanel, Bona, all the names that we are used to revere."
Those household names.
Yeah.
Cabanel. Bonnets.
Totally.
Love him, them, her. But always, they're on the coffee table. Big, we have big, thick volumes on the coffee. Of Cabanel Bonnet's work. Big, big, thick volumes. So all the plates.
So many pages.
There's so many plates. Just, yeah.
One day in 1875, Mary was walking along Le Boulevard Haussmann, one of those white streets synonymous with Parisian architecture, the streets that would soon be immortalized by an impressionist, Pizarro. When she passes a pastel work in a store window, she stops dead in her tracks. And there she is, without warning, experiencing her own haystack feeling.
Ooh, haystack feeling.
Yeah, remember
it's
that?
Been a while. It's been a while.
Okay. To get a better look, she presses her nose against a store display window.
Yeah, she gives it a little piggy nose.
Yeah,
it's a store window. Like, exactly.
Greasing it up. Quote, "The first time I saw a Degas pastel was the turning point in my life. I saw painting as I wanted to see it." End quote.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
We don't know which piece of Degas spurred a haystack feeling in Mary, but it's likely that it was one of the many pastels of ballerinas Degas had started to work from just a few years prior.
And we can imagine that she was drawn to how the figure seemed just caught in mid-motion, right? How the atmosphere itself conveyed as much feeling as the figures rendered. The looseness of the pastel marks, how nothing seemed final, but still very much caught in just this moment of being. The color both rendering the scene depicted and also becoming its own property to consider.
This must have seemed like a strange, otherworldly vision when compared to the drab ass salon, right? Which was very much still on the periphery. This new approach to making, to capturing the aliveness of the world, was going to revolutionize art. And interestingly, while Edouard wouldn't have known who Mary Cassatt was, he actually admired her work as well for a similar sauce that he was chasing in his own work as well.
Yeah, a little souffle.
Mary's work had been making gradual shifts, pushing ever so slightly the boundaries of Le Salon's taste. In her portrait titled Ida from 1874, Ida's face is depicted in a golden Gaussian glow while her dress and scarf are painted with loose, expression-y but decisive marks. And Edouard, upon seeing it, said, quote, "Now there's someone who feels as I do," end quote. Degas didn't realize that Ida was by a woman. And spoiler, if he did, it might have sullied his view of Mary's work. Post-Haystack feeling, Mary was diving even deeper into the colorful and the painterly. Mm-hmm. In 1875, the painting, Woman on Striped Cow.
Woman on Striped Cow. Love a woman. Love a sturdy woman. Riding atop a striped cow. I love it. It's beautiful.
That's a zebra.
Striped cow is not a zebra. Striped horse would be a zebra.
Oh, my God.
Striped cow is not a zebra.
Oh, my God. I need to stop talking. Okay. I'm back. Wow. Okay. One, two, three. Her 1875. Okay.
No, we're leaving it. Keep going. Striped cow's staying.
All right.
Striped cow's here to stay.
Well, okay. All right. So.
Striped cow.
All right. Striped cow.
There's people at home just chanting striped cow, striped cow, striped cow.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
At least
energy.
One person is. And if you're not, you should be.
Okay. So the painting's actual name striped is cow, Woman striped on Striped.
Sorry. Start over.
Okay. The painting's name is Woman on Striped Couch. Yes, I said it. Okay. Sometimes I black out. Sometimes
oh
I black out.
Oh, my God.
All right. Her 1875 painting called... Stop!
Why do you keep restarting? This is all staying.
Because...
This is all staying.
Fine. All right. The woman sitting on the striped couch, okay? If you look on the bottom right corner, she has left a wet brush stroke. She's let it linger there, and she let it dry. She didn't fix it. She didn't try and do anything to hide it. She just left it there, and I fucking love that.
Yeah, yeah. Variable speeds. There's marks. There's textures. Her backgrounds are looking brighter now. There's even, like, some translucency kind of coming in, you know, reflecting off of that canvas. Like, she's allowing the canvas to shine through, so we get more of that bright-ass color shining back at her eyeballs, right? Giving this kind of like sunshine hitting a terracotta pot sort of effect.
Yes,
you know what I mean? It's not like a fluorescent glow. It's not like a red that's like burning your retinas. It's still earthy.
It's a natural.
But it's sunshine. Like that sunshine is there.
Sun natural.
Very different. I love it.
Yes. So all of these beautiful things we just said about this work caused
striped
her to eventually be rejected from the salon.
Yeah. They're like, we don't want your striped cows here, ma'am.
No, ma'am.
Yeah.
No, ma'am. So, gradually becoming more and more acquainted with her work, one day in 1877, Degas, who had been corralling those New Wave Salon rejects.
Yeah, much like you could corral a cow.
The soon-to-be impressionist, right? Made a visit to Mary's studio. Mm-hmm. And while Edouard and Mary were a totally platonic and very unlikely pairing due to their polar opposite views of humanity and all, Cassatt was developing a strong belief in the suffrage movement. Mm. Meanwhile, Degas was developing a strong hatred for most women thanks to his belief in physiognomy.
Yeah, sure.
Stupid word for a stupid concept. They hit it off. Mm-hmm. If anyone, particularly a woman, could handle Ed's misogyny and tantrums and still call him out, it was Mary. Mm. She could let her sharp wit loose and that lack of religion to guide her. And not worry about him getting offended.
Mm-hmm.
Part of their friendship/frenemyship was that they respected each other's work and work ethic immensely. And they had a lot in common, but in like kind of that bizarro reflection world type of way.
Right. Degas' family, like Mary's, had gained like new money type wealth from banking.
Mm-hmm.
And Degas became, like Cassatt, also very opinionated, but in that kind of race science kind of way that we mentioned earlier. Also, he was very drawn to the arts, despite his family's insistence on him pursuing a career that would continue the family's wealth, not just kind of like leech from it, right? Mm-hmm. And both chose art over relationships and marriage, believing it to be incompatible with the artist's life. When Degas' father died and his brother bankrupted the family's new wealth fortune, Degas was forced to actually start selling his work, painting like his family's life depended on it because it actually started to depend on it.
After also being rejected by the salon multiple times, Ed took a risk and chose to side with those upstart impressionists, changing his own more classically trained work to fit in, eschewing, I don't know how to pronounce this. This is wine and wind to me.
Yeah.
Eschewing the impression. Are you going to correct me?
We'll see. We'll see. At this point, I don't know what I'm leaving in.
Eschewing the impressionist focused on painting outdoors, as he preferred more controlled compositions, frequently working from memory to arrive at those vibrant vibes.
Mm.
Part of his marketing plan was for the Impressionists to start exhibiting on their own, giving the Parisian public a new choice. Mm. Choices are good. Rather than relying on the same old salon exhibitions year after year. In 1877, Mary was rejected by the salon again, but this would be the last time. And she told Ed what happened. He said, Mary, they did you dirty. Mm-hmm. Okay, exhibit with us instead. Us is in the Impressionists. And a huge weight was lifted from Mary's shoulders. Quote, I agreed gladly. At last, I could work absolutely independently without worrying about the possible opinion of a jury. Mm. I hated conventional art. I was beginning to live. Ooh. End quote. Sans the pressure of the salon, yes. Mary was free to paint whatever the hell she wanted. And Ed was super supportive. Their studios were just around the corner from one another, so they would offer... They would critique each other's work a lot. But Ed was... He would still say shit like this, quote...
No.
I'm going to keep going. I'm like,
take that one again, dog.
See how long he's getting. Dog? I'm cow, bitch. I'm a striped cow. Okay.
You're off the rails.
We need this energy, okay? All right.
I like it.
And you'd rather it be me than you.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Beep. Ed was still
Ed. He was Ed. Still Ed.
He was still Ed.
Yeah.
And he was still say shit like, quote, I can't believe a woman draws as well as you. Most women paint like they're trimming hats, end quote. What is wrong with trimming hats? That sounds lovely
Nothing.
To me. He really did, probably deep down, actually admire her work.
Right.
And dare we say, he was even inspired by how she would challenge herself with different materials and different ways of working.
Right. I mean, I think we all need studio friends like this. Hopefully they're not as lecherous as Degas, but someone who will keep you honest, challenge you, and maybe even someone to have like a little healthy competition with.
Yeah, that's true. Unfortunately, Degas was still lecherous. Mm-hmm. Quote, Degas sometimes became angry because he could not find any weaknesses in me. And sometimes we did not see each other for months at a time until something I had painted brought us back together again. End quote. But their paths diverged there, listeners. Edouard was able to pretty much go anywhere he wanted in French society, okay? Wherever, including seedy locations like bars or dance halls.
Yes, this is the like great Guigny divide, if you will.
Yes.
Right. The unfiggled truth.
Yes, unfiggly. Yeah. Befiggled. Yeah. Okay, yes, yes.
He painted those ballerina girls who were from less privileged classes as young as 12 years old and were often groomed into prostitution through those same dance studios. Edgar's depictions of those dancers almost feels like they're kind of studies of like athletic objects at best, and at worst, studies in his beloved physiognomy, however you say that.
And Mary's subjects were a stark contrast, right? Intimate portrayals of children, caregivers, and mothers, which makes sense because this was the world that she had access to.
Right.
And while many of her works might, on first glance, read as flowery, unrealistic depictions of family and motherhood, we are missing a lot of context with our 21st century lenses. For example, many of the motherly figures were actually nannies, governesses, wet nurses, whatever you want to call them, highlighting the work of childcare, the domestic factory, if you will.
All from an upper middle class perspective, yes, but something that was way different from all of the idealized paintings of the Virgin Mary, not Mary Cassatt, carrying a little BBJ. Ma'am. Mother. Ma'am. Mom.
Mother. Ma'am.
Mother Mary. This became both a source of reliable income, but also an honest investigation into the work of women.
And this is super interesting when you remember that Mary was unmarried, child-free, and from the upper middle class.
Yeah, I mean, I think it shows that she saw herself in relationship to laborers. Like, mm-hmm. She saw her work as labor itself.
Yeah.
And you can trace this all back to that Protestant work ethic mm-hmm. that was instilled in her from her, like, husk years. Remember the husk years?
Yeah.
Idle hands being, like, the devil's workshop and all. You know, if you have those idle hands, you're putting on that Cordell Stewart jersey with the holes in it and hanging out at the abandoned Kmart, right, with the Dunkin' Donuts coffee. Or what did they say you have? I don't remember. And while you can make the argument that Degas' ballerinas also showed the labor involved, Cassatt's handling of her laborers is just way more human. There's such a human touch there.
Right.
And it shows that she was thinking about labor that was never really considered labor. It's considered just a woman's world. You know what I mean? Just something that you have to do as a duty or something.
Yes.
You have to wipe duty as your duty.
I was going to say duty. Anyway.
Patties. Striped patties. Striped cow patties from striped cows.
On a bun?
Well, no, you don't. You don't eat the patties. I know it's confusing because hamburger patties, but you don't eat the cow patties.
What if I knew? Beep. She continued to explore these familiar moments while taking huge leaps experimentally and conceptually late in her career, directly inspired by ukiyo-e woodblock prints in a series of etched color prints known as the Set of 10.
If you remember back to our talk with like Emily Beeney, like Mary actually had to like reverse engineer how these prints were made.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was this really interesting process. If you haven't listened to that interview, go back and listen to it. I don't know which number it is, but you'll see it. You'll see it.
Yeah. You'll see it. And in this series, we have scenes of children being comforted or getting wrangled for their nightly bath, but also more intimate moments of women, like what you might have seen in ukiyo-e prints. Mm. They're bathing, they're fixing their long hair, they're licking fancy envelopes, and they're traveling on trams, a fabulous life. And this is giving us more context to the lives of these upper-class women and the women who often worked closely with them. So Mary, now nearing her 50s, was still allowing all of these different influences to challenge her work, never losing sight of the subject matter that she would always investigate. And when that mural commission offer landed at her door all the way from Chicago, she would dive deep into the role of women's labor while envisioning the future that labor could lead to by exploring the story of the woman who first brought life and knowledge into this world, Eve. But unlike the biblical account, Mary's Eve would pluck fruit from the tree of knowledge, not to undo humanity, but to empower it. So, listeners, and I am talking to you, listeners, specifically.
Those of you listening with your earbuds and your precious little ears.
Yes, exactly.
Softly, sweetly.
If you're
listening to our voices. Maybe you're falling asleep. Well, pull out your phone. Pull it up. Turn the brightness up. All the way up.
If you recall back to our Augusta Savage episode, typically large artworks and buildings made for world fairs are destroyed afterwards. Mm. And Mary's Modern Woman was no exception. It was lost. So, as we do our best to give you a mental vision of this mural, piecing together from paintings of Mary's from around this time, as well as other artists she was influenced by, and Sally Webster's historical account of the mural called Eve's Daughters, you may want to follow along with all of the images we discuss.
If you're listening on Spotify, you can switch from audio to video. While you're there, tap that little five-star button.
Tap, tap, tap.
Only the five stars. All tap, of the tap. Five stars. All of them.
All of them.
You heard me.
All of them.
Even if you don't like me, all of them.
You like me, right? I'm worth five stars, right? Or you can switch over to YouTube, link in the show notes, and of course, hit that thumbs up. Dingle that bell. Subscribe. Thank you.
Lastly, not leastly, you can follow along at artslicepod.com. While you're there, sign up for our free newsletter.
Algorithm free.
So you can be alerted to when new episodes come out.
Also just fun content.
Yeah.
New stuff
from
us.
Yeah. And we don't spam you.
We're anti-spam. We're anti-algorithm.
We don't spam you. We wow you. You
thought oh my God,
you
no.
thought I was going to say wham. We wham you.
No.
I said wow.
Okay. All right.
But wham would have worked too. We kablam you.
Oh my God, what is that even from? Is that like from a comic book? Kablam! Like, five stars. That was worth five stars to me. So back to where we started with this whole episode, with Mary receiving a commission letter from American philanthropist and innovator, or rather supervisor of the creation of the brownie. Yes, the brownie, Bertha Palmer. I say supervisor because Bertha simply wished for a portable cake type sort of treat.
A little Debbie's or equivalent, if you will.
Yes. Because
homemade.
You have things to see, places to go when you're at the fair. And what if you want a little bit of cake?
Exactly.
You got to have your cake and eat it too.
Right. Innovative. Right?
So she was an extremely wealthy socialite, which meant that she ran with those new money upper 10 and old money circles. And see, she was the president of the Board of Lady Managers.
Okay. Okay.
It's a lot of work.
Okay.
You got to have a lot of energy for that, okay?
Boss bitch.
So the yes.
Yeah.
BB.
Yeah.
So the lady managers, as seen here, is this image here. Okay. So she's on top of this kind of identification flowchart, and she's
also
numero
looks
uno.
Kind of like a pyramid scheme. honest.
She's number one of 11. Yeah. Okay. And so these lady managers were in charge of managing the first ever women's building for the 1893 World Columbian Exposition and Fair held in Chicago.
Okay.
And the Brownie Pyramid scheme.
Right. Yeah.
Apparently. Now, sticking it to Edgar Degas and all of the misogynists may have been good motivation to take this mural on.
Mm-hmm. Also, but the brownies. She's getting brownies, I assume, sent to her. Note on top of the brownie, deep dish brownie. Deep dish.
Oh,
Chicago,
I love that.
Deep dish brownie.
Hell yeah.
Note on top.
Sign me up to try this new treat.
3 months to travel across the seas. Brownies are still good.
I would still eat it. No, I wouldn't. That's gross because there weren't preservatives. Anyway.
Immediate tummy ache.
The impact of this mural would go beyond some petty-ass dudes. So this was a huge opportunity for Mary for many reasons. Mm-hmm. So she'd have the ability to speak on behalf of the women that she had been painting, right, and observing for these past three decades.
Not to mention, she would be among the first women artists to paint a mural in the USA, baby.
Baby, yes. Which is a huge deal, generally, because these jobs are typically assigned to men. But not just in the U.S. We are also decades ahead of Mexican muralism because it's 1893.
Okay.
But there would be a few female Mexican muralists among the greats.
This could all be super daunting and high pressure, but Mary lived on that energy. Mm-hmm. She lived for the energy. And artists do that, too. Like, when something is new, when something is exciting, kind of fills your reservoir, if you will, with that
dopamine.
Energy, with that energy dopamine that it's yes. Like, here's a new project. Here is a new thing to accomplish. Yes. Here is a new walnut to crack. Crack it.
And then sprinkle it on the brownie.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
So, right,
yeah, exactly.
All
good,
of that.
Good, good, all good connection that. There.
And she was also willing to undertake this literally massive work, even at the age of almost 50, which mm-hmm. meant for her having to build a deep trench in her backyard, build an enclosure over that mm-hmm. just to work on this 58x14 monster.
Wow.
Monster.
Wow. I really wish there were photos of this because I just want to know, like, logistically how it happened. You know?
So how when it's
the
made.
Yeah, exactly. So when the canvas mason, the person who created this incredibly specifically sized and shaped canvas structure, wasn't completing it fast enough, Mary actually, like, rolled up her sleeves, her little blousy sleeves, and helped him get it done. Like, she was ready to go. She's on that brownie sugar rush. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yes, yes. She had the means, the work ethic, and the passion to completely crush it. Not mm-hmm. to mention, she was never afraid of a challenge,
right?
And spoiler, crush it she did. So she can definitely have that brownie. Listeners, how did Mary prepare for this mural that was envisioning the future of women? Well, she combed over her varied influences, finding visual and conceptual ties from proto-feminist literature and essays. Then, reminiscing on her travels, looking at Correggio's Italian frescoes, studying Botticelli's flattened pictorial compositions, Art Nouveau turning naturalism into design, and those Japanese ukiyo-e compositions that were still buzzing in her mind. And if that wasn't enough inspo, Mary found herself studying contemporary illustration. If you recall from our episode on Irish illustrator and stained glasser Harry Clark, the golden age of illustration was booming. Book illustrators' work was reaching millions of people, and Mary was no exception.
She may have seen a kindred spirit in the young English illustrator Kate Greenaway, whose whimsical Art Nouveau style often featured ruffled and
fuck. It's fighting to get out.
Often featured ruffled and bonneted children frolicking in bucolic landscapes.
Kind of looks like Wonagog's Robbie Bobby.
Jill. I mean, it's very likely that printmaker, illustrator, children's book author Wonagog grew up reading Kate Greenaway's books back in New Ulm, Minnesota. So with these more illustrative influences, she's learning how to push her storytelling skills further, although maybe a bit too much for critics.
Which brings us to
baby orbs,
or rondelles. The top of the mural is semicircular shaped or tympanum shaped to remain aesthetically cohesive with the architecture of the building and the theme modern women manifested into three distinct panels that evolved into a triptych. However, three of those panels are framed by some thick Renaissance-inspired borders, and I mean thick.
Like 3.5 feet wide thick.
So thick.
Talking very thick, like filled with vines and floating baby orbs. Yep.
Portraits of fleshy, pudgy babies in these marginal roundels, mm-hmm. and these shapes were very popular during the Renaissance.
I also think Mary is kind of staking her claim. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, you might know me from my baby paintings. don't forget, I'm the baby painter.
We'll call back.
Yeah.
There are also some diamond shapes, so maybe diamondelles, with full-grown ladies or maybe teenagers, maybe. We don't know. We don't know who they are. None of these people. The women, the babies, or maybe there's even a goddess in there, because Mary did not leave us a cheat sheet.
I see these baby orbs as kind of seeds, as this is a, as you'll see, listeners, this is a very horticultural-based mural, okay? So this is like the idea of passing on new generations, at least in my mind.
So the border, the orbs, well, they're interesting, but we'll reserve our thoughts on the border for later. But like we said, it does serve its purpose, splitting the actual content of the mural into a triptych. Telling three separate but connected stories, the passing down of knowledge, sciences, and the arts.
Stephanie, it's like, it's hot in here. It's like 97 degrees hot. And I'm prepared for this pantry. I have a pantry right here from the excellent painter, podcaster, and art educator, Claire Lockhart. Thank you, Claire.
Thank you, Claire.
Let's go to the Art Size Pantry.
Vámonos.
Hey, friends. It's me, Claire Lockhart, from the History of Modern Art with Claire podcast. Your favorite Art Slice hosts asked me very nicely to define what a triptych is in order to appease the pantrymon. A triptych is an object created by an artist made out of a trio of components. The tri in triptych means three, like in triangle, tricycle, or triceratops. But instead of having three mighty horns, a triptych has three awesome compositions. Artists began making triptychs back in the Middle Ages in Europe. They were often created as altarpieces to adorn churches. These triptychs were typically created by connecting three panels together with hinges. Imagine a big square panel for the centerpiece, and on the left, there's a vertical rectangle that is half the width of the square, and it's attached with hinges. On the right of the middle square, there's a second, tall, skinny rectangle also connected with hinges. They were created this way so the artwork could be folded up and transported. Not all triptychs require such strict geometric shapes, though. Sometimes the panels were pointed or arched on the top edge. Sometimes all three panels were equal sizes. Triptychs have evolved over time, and contemporary artists have the ability to create variations on this centuries-old three-part composition. Basically, any work of art that involves three individual components can be considered a triptych. Many artists will invoke the traditional triptych and attach three different panels together to create a larger work of art. Sometimes artists will make three separate pieces that are displayed near each other, but they are connected by theme instead of being physically joined together. The next time you see a work of art composed of three elements, I want you to show off your fancy art brain and point out that it is a triptych. After your friends are impressed by your intellect, go out and celebrate with a banana split with three scoops of ice cream.
Stephanie, our little pantrymon's tummies have been satiated once again. They're kind of napping over here in a big, big, hot, sweaty heap.
Yeah.
Kind of disgusting. They're all, they got that matted down fur.
Yes, they do.
On account of sweating.
Right.
Much like we have glossy faces on account of sweating.
Right.
But we once again want to thank Claire Lockhart for doing that little pantry for us.
Thank you so much, Claire.
She did it a while ago.
A while ago.
We're very delayed on these episodes, yes. Listeners. I think our little podcast eyes are bigger than our podcast tummies. You know what I'm saying? What our podcast tummies can handle.
Thank you, Claire. Everyone, we'll have more info in the show notes.
Yeah, check her out. She's a great painter. And
love those Brodalisques. Panel number one, young girls pursuing fame. While we might only have two black and white photographs to go off of, we looked at Mary's work from around this time to get a sense of the color palette that she was using, right? Because black and white photograph. Green and blue are the painting's major keys with trace notes of red, yellow, and white. Mary's palette is hot. It's very saturated, and the figures get lost in a rich tapestry of green leaves and patches of blue sky. So in the first panel, I think it's an overcast day under what we assume are patches of clear blue, and that overcast sky, diffused in spring light, there is an open field, painted in what critics described as, quote, bright grass green. And there we have the horizon of which will narratively connect the triptych panels.
And it's a really open field.
Huge.
Like a horizon so clear and devoid of trees, you notice like that slight curvature of the earth there.
Right. Like roughly 2/3 grass and 1/3 sky, because it honestly seems like it's really jarring because it's so sparse.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we're looking at a grainy ass photograph.
Look at this photograph.
Yes. There are also geese following, chasing, flying menacingly towards a gaggle of young girls.
How did our eyes get so red? The geese were the geese pecking at our heads.
Okay. 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 I'm actually
pecking at our heads.
You held that note.
Oh, no, it's fine.
That note was great. That note was
great. I thought it was good. But
it was fantastic, actually.
Okay.
Everyone, Russell was in a band once. Russell was in a band once. He did lead vocals.
I would not call it that, but okay.
Yes. All right.
It's a couple of people. We got together. We did it. We thought we were a band, but we weren't.
Back to the girls getting attacked by geese.
Yeah.
They are running from the geese, but they're wearing flowy dresses, okay? And flowy, you would say, if you were a citizen of 1890, porque they aren't wearing corsets. That's a big deal. Mm. Their dresses are billowing.
There's loose in there.
So, yes, everything's loose.
Ungodly. That's why the geese are after them.
Dresses, maybe.
Yeah.
Their dress is billowing behind them like a, you know, drying sheet on a clothing line.
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone even know what that is anymore? Gen Z, do you know what a clothing line is?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Does Gen Z even know what that is?
Stop.
They don't know what photographs are.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
They don't know what photographs are.
Phonographs?
They know what photos are on the phone, but they don't know what a photograph is.
They know what a photograph is.
I don't think so.
Listeners. Gen Zers.
They don't even know. They don't know about burned CDs, Stephanie. They don't understand how digital media gets on physical media. They don't understand that.
Maybe that part they don't, because okay. So back to the girls that are getting attacked by said geese. There's one who's looking back at the geese, but what are they running towards? And we know they're running away from the geese, but what are they running towards, okay? If you look up in the sky, you're going to see a flying, wingless, nude girl.
Yeah.
Herself heading into the horizon. She's headed there.
With a trumpet.
Yes. Nude girl, wingless, with trumpet in the sky.
Yeah.
See, the sky was reserved.
Far away from the geese.
The sky was reserved for this figure. Many critics believe this nude figure to be Fame, or a reinterpretation of Fame.
Fame as in the Greek mythology. The daughter of Gaia, the goddess of the earth. Mary's Fame, though, or Feme, or Femme, is not depicted with those Greek goddess wings and toga-type dresses, just nude.
Mary is taking the task of modern woman to heart. Maybe that's why she's not wearing any clothes. She's modern. Mary's reflecting on the changing times, at least the changing times for the upper middle-class white women. Thanks in part to a budding suffragette movement, women's health was finally being addressed, all those veal issues, and the many health concerns with corset wearing had led to a trend in less structured casual dresses, letting that soft veal loose. Let it loose. Okay. Let it loose, ladies. Listen, we aren't to pants yet. We're not getting that crazy. But for 1890, this might have been nearly as radical as going braless for some onlookers.
Yeah.
And these girls also, no tienen shoes. They're not wearing shoes. They are barefoot.
Mm-hmm.
And they're running, though. I can't emphasize this enough. They're running. They're running through that grass.
They're no longer veal.
No, they're free.
Yeah, they got some muscle mass.
Yeah, I'm not going to pretend to understand that I know what these geese represent. 19th century ladies should not be running.
Running from the geese, found the girls they were looking for.
The geese found the girls.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
You can really put anything to these lyrics.
Yes, you can. Yes, you can. Okay.
So once again, I feel like
it's going to turn into a karaoke session.
I feel like it was good.
It was good.
I feel like it wasn't as underappreciated. It's okay. It's fine. I'm fine with being underappreciated. It's all right.
You're not underappreciated.
Yeah. You can tell because I'm saying I'm fine with it, but I'm fine with being underappreciated.
Okay.
That's what underappreciated people say, that they're okay with it. They constantly need, you know, to say that they're okay with being underappreciated, and it's totally fine.
In addition to the eschewing of corsets, exercise was starting to be encouraged for women. And it made the wealthy mothers worry.
Yeah. The wealthy boys won't come knocking for my sturdy daughters. They're too sturdy.
Okay.
Like they want the pale jello and bones kind of babes just held together with their corsets.
Yeah.
They want that whole, like, you know, take the corset off, kind of like, you know, flatten.
Puddle
sort of situation. Mm-mm. Yeah. That's what they want on their wedding nights.
No good.
Yeah.
No good.
These aren't sturdy men either. You know, I feel like they're, you know, they're kind of, everybody's a puddle. It's a puddle-based society back then. Puddle and Bones. That's another.
This is great.
That's very Nickelback, Puddle and Bones. That's the band that opened for Nickelback.
Yeah.
Puddle and Bones.
Puddle and Bones. Yeah. That's a good one. These mothers were worried. Okay. These are the things that they were thinking. Quote, "If my daughter looks strong and moves with a will, she will be mistaken for a worker, for a servant. If she looks delicate and moves languidly, it will be seen at once that she does not belong to the working class."
Mm. Again, basically Veal. I will say that this is kind of flipped in our era. Mm-hmm. Like, those who have the material means are much more likely to be in shape, yeah, have like personal screeners, have like Botox, have like the lip injections, all that stuff, which is fine. You know, yeah, the healthcare, they have healthcare too. Yeah. That's great. So I wish we had, I mean, we kind of have healthcare. We have sort of healthcare. One of the major backlashes Mary faced for this mural was this panel. Mm. There was a lot of confusion about the geese, the intention of fame, what Nickelback had to do with it, if anything at all. You know, I don't understand why that was playing behind the mural, you know? I'm not that clear on it either. Like, fame, the Greek goddess, was considered kind of like a gossipy troublemaker.
Mm.
And we'll see in the next panel, Mary is kind of taking back these stories of famous women stepping outside of their womanly boundaries. So it is possible that she's attempting to take back the idea of fame as well.
Or she's just calling everyone a gossipy bitch. I'm not chismosa.
Maybe. it's like literal fame too, like legacy as something for women to strive towards, you know, to run towards, away from. What do the geese have to do with it? That's what I want to know. Like, yeah, are the geese chasing them towards fame? Are they running along with them?
It is a bit confusing. And fame herself, I mean, maybe it's the image, but I don't think so, because she seems really wonko. Like, it's a weird pose. And I'm guessing that she didn't have a model for it.
Or maybe that area was just like really hard to reach from her like trench situation.
I guess you could say that she winged it.
Yeah.
Moving on. Panel number 2. Young women plucking from the tree of knowledge or science.
Luckily, the mural gets much more accessible and more prescriptive from here on out.
Yes, we have the central panel, the largest of the three, and it's only slightly larger than the panels bookending it, but it's not confined to the curved ends of the coved ceiling.
I think this composition, separated from the other two in the triptych, just fundamentally works better on just like a formal level.
Yeah.
Even though it's not much larger in terms of scale from the other two in the triptych, the horizon line carries through from panel number 1 mm-hmm. into the orchard, which makes it feel larger, warmer, more immersive. So it's really using the real estate that mural has much better than the other two.
Right.
And being a little bit busier, a little bit more wooded, you know, all nestled into that orchard, there's a lot more narrative bits for the viewer to find and then chew on.
Munch on, yeah. Snack.
And if, you know, if apples are your snacks.
Visual snack.
Yeah. And that hides any flaws in the painting's execution. So you can't like pick apart any isolated, like funky looking nude figure without wings, right?
It also doesn't hurt that this is the most legible of the photographed panels.
Mm.
This portion of the mural was actually repurposed by Mary in 3 paintings from around this time. So we can actually find elements of it in Young Women Picking Fruit from 1891 to 92, Baby Reaching for an Apple from 1893 exactly, and The Family from 1893. So by looking at those, we get a strong sense of the colors that were used in this portion.
And Mary's using like pretty electric colors for the time.
Yeah.
The greens are like these beautiful cadmium greens. The orange, the red blush, they kind of like glow on the cheeks of the figures.
Yeah.
But separated from the mural, when they're kind of spliced and diced like this, they really lack that conceptual punch that the mural has. That reimagining of the Garden of Eden is just completely lost.
Right. It all works when it's together. And she titled it Young Women Plucking from the Tree of Knowledge or Science. So we are devoid of men. We are devoid
men.
Of snakes. Instead, it's filled with Eves, leading younger Eves through the process of gathering knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And there are 3 clusters of Eves spread out throughout the panel, again, in loose clothing. And surrounded by those orchard trees, we have friendly turkeys and doggies. The left side has 3 younger Eves, preteens, if you will.
Preteeves. Preteeves.
Yeah, preteeves. One looks interested at the work taking place in front of her, and the other one kind of looks pouty and tired, or maybe she's tired of holding that basket of apples, which honestly, relatable mood, because at the end of the work week, my eyes are glazed over and I'm barely hanging on to my apples,
manzanas. So that preteeve attitude.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Even though those knowledge apples that they're chomping on are valuable, they're valuable for your tummy, keep the doctor away.
That's right.
Keep the knowledge coming.
Right.
Anyway, but you only have so many apples to give every day, right? You can only eat so many apples.
Yes.
So you got to count your apples, make sure you're not overexerting your apple quota for the day.
Right, right.
To their right in the center, one woman stands on a ladder pulling fruit from the tree and then handing it off to a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially the transferring of knowledge from one generation to the next.
Literally.
Kind of going back to the baby orbs.
Literally.
Yeah. I think it works a little better than the baby orbs.
Yes.
Arguably.
It does.
Although
it does.
I do like the idea of baby orbs.
I don't know about that.
I just don't think they work here.
Not here.
And there's no snake here to tempt them, you know, and I wish there was a snake, because I think the snake was unjustly vilified here. The snake is offering knowledge to these people, so.
This is the snake's villain story.
Yeah, I mean, put a little dress on it. That's fine. Put a little, not a corset,
little
I guess.
Bonnet.
A little bonnet on it. Yeah, and it's a lady. It's a beautiful lady snake who's trying to give you knowledge. So they own their pursuit of gathering the knowledge completely.
Mm-hmm. Right.
No snakes in the picture.
In Mary's 1893 painting, The Family, we can actually match the young girl from that composition to the one in the grainy photograph receiving the apples.
Mm.
She's got the same hair, the same sleeves, the same face.
Mm-hmm.
Same
pre-teeve disposition, right?
Yeah, same attitude.
And you know, paintings take a long time to complete, so it's likely Mary was working on these simultaneously. Like we said, the colors just soar in those three paintings that are based on the mural, or vice versa, maybe. Mm-hmm. They also seem more connected to her recent print work than her earlier impressionist paintings.
Yeah.
So there are larger chunks of tones. There's a bit of pushing and pulling with the colors that make up the composition. And according to a critic, we're quote unquote corn and violet against green.
Who is corn colored?
I think the children are probably corn colored, but corn color is pretty vague.
It's so vague.
The colors that I see that are the closest to a corn type color seem like they come from like maybe a hardier stock of corn.
Okay.
A sturdy, healthy corn.
Okay.
Not that like mushy, pale veal corn we produce here in our factory farmed fields.
Right.
That makes a sweat corn sweat. You know what I'm talking
Jesus,
about?
Oh, Jesus, that corn,
corn
sweat.
Corn that you kind of need a steak knife for.
So beside the little girl receiving the apples, there are grown women steading ladders and handing fruit to one another. This just continues on for a couple iterations there. Mm-hmm. And there's just a lot of attention giving to the differing designs of those non-corseted dresses that those adult women are wearing.
Mm-hmm.
Like the fabrics look soft and light. The patterns are perfectly illustrated. They have puffy sleeves with lace accents. They've got wide collars, wide lace collars. Even some of them are wearing Mary Janes.
Mm.
Honestly, this looks like 90s Victorian-inspired fashion.
Yeah, it looks a little bit like Elaine from Seinfeld.
Oh, definitely.
Maybe
yes.
She's doing some astral traveling to the past.
Definitely. Although, I don't think she'd be caught dead picking apples in an orchard, to be honest. I wouldn't bat twice if they were wearing chunky shoes or combat boots under those long-ass dresses.
Mm.
And as I say this, it's really dawning on me how much the 90s borrowed from Victorian fashion. Like, you got your chokers, your loose buns, those flowy floral dresses with mm-hmm. those puffy sleeves. And these clusters of women, they, like I said, they continue throughout the orchard. And it's really harmonious. And it's a really peaceful scene that's actually making me crave pasta primavera and apples.
And apples.
And
yeah,
manzanas.
Together.
Yes, actually, that would be a very nice, refreshing salad, especially in this goddamn heat. This godforsaken heat. Panel number three, art, music, dancing. In this final panel, that horizon line continues from the previous two panels. And this time, this panel is less barren than the first, but we do have a little bit of foliage.
A little pocket forest, if
yes,
you will.
Yes, yeah. On the horizon there. And we have some irises on the lower left-hand corner, which historically have symbolized faith and wisdom, but also positive change. And the fact that they are white, to me, signals that this is a new beginning.
And just like the potted tree there for some reason.
Random-ass potted tree.
A little potted tree there for some particular reason. I'm not sure why.
Maybe it's symbolizing like spinsters, like, hey, it's okay to be alone and in a box. You can still thrive and be fabulous.
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
How else do you explain the lonely tree in the corner? But opposite of lonely, we actually have three women in a semicircle in another kind of bare block of grass.
It's giving like ukiyo-e almost cut and pasted forms. It's a little bit hard to describe, but it's those ukiyo-e moments where you only see the general shapes of like a figure or a cloud, and they kind of just blur into a general form. You know, it could be the photograph, though. Maybe the photograph is losing some resolution there.
Could be this photograph. Okay, so back to the women. They were meant to personify art, music, and dancing.
Mm-hmm.
So we have art sitting on the far left, closest to us, nearest the potted tree. Now, I don't see a palette. I don't see a paintbrush. Nothing to me or Russell screams artist. What she is doing is sitting and observing the other two, and that is intentional. Yes, Mary has chosen to depict art as simply looking, which is something that here on La Isla de Art Slice, we preach.
We proselytize, so like looking at life, looking at art, just being open and intaking and processing whatever you see as you go about the world. You know, yeah. It sharpens your wood, as Mary would say. I think it was wood. Now I'm thinking it might be wit. Maybe it was sharpening your wit. Wood or wit, it's best to keep whatever that is sharpened.
Yes, keep it sharp.
Don't overdo your apples per diem.
Right.
Keep your apples to a moderate amount and whittle right. your wood or your wits.
Right, yes.
Yeah, okay, look at things.
Who needs
which
grit?
Which is also whittling your wood or wits.
But grit, if you have wood or wits, right? Music is also sitting, and she's looking down and plucking away at her banjo. And we know Mary loves her banjo playing women. And she also has a voluminous dress and sleeves that echo the shape of her banjo. And then on the far right is dance. And she is facing the other two and holding up her dress, dancing to that banjo.
Nice. Yeah.
And she's dancing a very contemporary dance that was contemporary at the time.
That's a great dance to Japanese.
It's some iteration of some kind of skirt dance, okay? And it's less academic, but it's a more populist alternative to ballet.
It's also another nod to pursuing physical and mental health through like activity and the arts.
Right.
But also, you know, I think she's maybe taking a little jab at her buddy, Degas.
Spike jab.
For his, you know, all his tortured ballerinas.
Yeah. There's definitely a specific undertone of physical expression not controlled by men. Like, she's smiling. I think she's smiling from this photograph. And she's having a good time. Mm-hmm. And these simple things should be commonplace, but even today, they feel revolutionary. And we need more of this, not just women, but all of us. Todos, nosotros, everybody. You, me, snakes. Them, the snakes,
yeah.
The cats.
We all need it.
The nosy neighbors. The cut-off family members, we all need this. And maybe we could all get along then. Maybe we could all get along. Got really personal.
Oh, gosh.
Watch it.
Oh, my God. Ugh. Stephanie.
Oh, God.
We've been dragging this, blown up to scale. Black and white photograph of Mary Cassatt's mural, a modern woman.
Yeah.
All the way to the doorsteps of La Isla de Art Slice. We're almost there.
Whoa, when did this orchard get here?
I don't know. Anyway, it's been a while since we've been here.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And of course, we have to decide. If it's gonna go in the Art Slice Museum, we gotta decide. You're filming this, right?
Yes.
All right. Well, I really hope we're recording. Oh my God!
Look, that's a snake.
It's a snake. Is that a snake with a bonnet?
It's offering us some fruit.
Should we take? I don't even know how it's holding two apples, but
yes, yes.
All right, sure. All right. Yeah. No, I'm really tired.
Mmm. So good.
Oh, that's a good apple.
Oh my God.
I really hope you're recording this.
Yes.
Because, I mean, they've got to see the snake.
Obviously.
Our listeners have to see the snake. Okay.
Obviously.
Listeners, if you're just listening, you know, come over. Watch the video. You're going to see the snake in the bonnet.
With your two
Stephanie
beautiful
definitely
eyes.
Hit record.
I definitely did.
So, we have to decide if Mary Cassatt's, I feel like I've already said this a few times, but anyway, if this blown up to scale, grainy black and white photograph is going, man, this is really giving me a boost, is going in the Art Slice Museum.
Yeah, right.
We should probably get back to the actual studio, though.
Yeah, let's go.
Do you really want to walk all that way back? I feel like I can with this apple now. You know
right,
I mean?
Exactly. My little apple.
All right, let's go.
Apple snack. Thanks, Snake.
Yeah, thank you.
Maybe I'm repeating myself, but I'm also underscoring just like how we might all look at this mural now and not think that it's anything particularly special, but actually it is revolutionary. And I know, it is borderline a crunchy image of barefoot women harvesting fruit. I'm aware. but I think that we need to think about the time and place a little bit more, listeners. Mary was already breaking norms in what she chose to paint while still playing that society game of looks and appearances. But here in public, she's giving society, namely women, a vision of a possible progressive future. Like thousands of people were going to see this mural. So she's planting visual seeds, if you will. So she wasn't just talking the talk. She was also an active suffragette. And Modern Eve is the mascot in this mural. And actually, Eve has continued to be an international icon for women's rights. It's celebrating different phases of a woman's life, you know, letting girls be girls, letting women be women, you know, not constricted in corsets by society. Or today, constricted by phones and social media. But I think the message is applicable to everybody, especially in 2025. And with this mural, I think Mary is also thinking about the message that she is leaving behind for future women, her legacy. She's very aware that there are younger artists already looking up to her. So she's definitely got that in the back of her mind. But like her mother baby paintings, she is also showing the labor that it's going to take to build this future, whether it was intentional for her or not. I definitely see that in there. Like, someone has to plant the trees. Someone has to organize the harvesting, right? Someone has to raise the baby. And it all starts with a vision, right? A visual vision. Someone seeing themselves in a mural located in an important place to imagine that better future and to realize that it is possible. Yeah. Could be possible.
But she chose not to have children.
I think she's acknowledging that it's not for everyone, but we can find our place in society, what we were meant to do.
Yeah.
Yes, because it takes a village. I think that's probably part of her, maybe intentionally or not, part of her message is maybe you're not the childbearer, but maybe you're harvesting fruit. Maybe you're holding a basket.
Yeah, get to take on those traditionally male roles as well.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
I want to circle back to your Eve thoughts, but first I do want to say, like, on a formal level, I've already kind of like hinted at this. I do kind of agree with the critics of this piece.
Yeah.
But from kind of like a caring way. Like, I want to have a crack at this in a studio critique. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Like, constructive feedback. Not in a critic kind of making a titillating read kind of way that's just going to make viewers feel like, oh, I got him. You know, I got
Mary. Trying to go viral for the 1893 times. Yeah, yeah.
Those thick-ass chunky borders and the orb babies, I know they are somehow tangentially connected to the overall piece, being like literal seeds of humans passing on the gene pool. And I also realize Mary's kind of referencing faux painting, like in architecture and older murals.
Trompe-l'œil,
exactly. But it does compromise the space, like splitting it into very segregated triptychs, and it forces the focal point, the actual like three panels, to be a little bit smaller in terms of like composition,
right?
In terms of real estate. So smaller borders, no borders, less baby orbs, no baby orbs, or maybe like integrated baby orbs already. I think that's looking a little bit better in my mind. The bookending panels too are also much weaker than the center panel. They're kind of awkward compositions on the bookends. They're not, they don't really work. And the MacMoney's mural, we didn't spend a lot of time looking at, but it does seem like each moment kind of flows into the next rather seamlessly.
Yeah.
And Mary shows that, like, the center panel she made for the triptych, like, works really well. It flows really well. Even just the motion of passing down the apples from trees creates this kind of connectivity to the viewer who can relate to that gesture.
Right.
Like, everyone has passed something they care about onto someone they care about. So you kind of connect to that in this weird way. And I do love that she stepped out of her comfort zone. She painted via a ditch in a greenhouse type situation. This was also like her first attempt at a mural. Like, she was influenced by a lot of different sources. Like, I love that. I'm just not sure it was tied together very well.
Right. She was not the first pick, actually, for this commission. Okay. Someone else who was around her age had declined.
Okay.
Because they were like, fuck no, I'm 45. I can't. That's a big ass project.
Well, Mary's
like
in her 50s. And yeah.
Yeah, but
so
maybe.
She maybe didn't have as much time to work on it as we think.
They actually didn't have that much time. I don't know how much time, but it seemed like it was a squeeze. I think that other artist was like, I'm old and I don't have the space. But like Mary was like, I have the space. That's true, though. She did have. Yeah. She was privileged. And so she did have the resources to get this done. And so she was able to take on that challenge. And that's pretty badass.
At this
itself.
Point, she had purchased a house outside of Paris, right? So she did have some area to work on the mural.
She had land.
But yeah, I don't know. Maybe it was a time constraint sort of situation. But sometimes the figures do seem kind of cut and pasted on. Like we mentioned, kind of like ukiyo-e, also a little bit like Botticelli. It works really well in the central panel where everything flows, but not so much on the bookended panels.
Right.
They're just left out in open air. And the pasting on sort of effect that I'm mentioning doesn't really play with space or perspective or proportion at all. It would have been interesting to see some things bigger than other things.
Oh, yeah.
But it, you know, it's all just kind of the same perspective, the same viewpoint. the same proportions. It just doesn't really play with composition in a way that you've seen her play with composition in her paintings.
And that matters even more in a mural that's so far up.
Right.
Like,
you have to consider that. Exactly. Exactly. And it works really well in her prints, you know?
Yes.
Like, she is playing with space in her prints, which she just made a few years before this. But yeah, it's a different ballgame when it's a huge-ass mural, right? You're not sure how to necessarily work those different sort of compositions into it and still make it feel cohesive.
Right.
So there was a lot going against her. And honestly, I think, it's kind of an airball. It's kind of an airball from Mary on the whole. Like, I think they're really good parts. But I really like it. I've said it before. I really like it when really well-known artists, when artists who are far better than me, make something that doesn't really work out.
Yeah.
I think that's very human. I think we can all learn from that, including Mary. I just wish that she had made like another mural to see kind of like what she learned from this mural and, you know, how she took that experience and translated it into another sort of large scale work. It would have been really great to see that.
But also think about documentation, what she would have had to take a picture of it before she shipped it off, you know, like what she's left with, like diagrams and sketches. I don't think she actually ever saw it in person.
The building or the...
The mural itself, like once it was installed, I don't think she went to Chicago.
Well, and that's a good point too. Like, I'm not sure how much she would have even seen of the architectural space too. So she's probably going off of diagrams. She's probably going off of like sketchups of the actual building. So I don't know.
She tried to work with the other...
She's kind of going in blind.
The other painter, Mary McMoney's, they were corresponding via letter. Can you imagine Weeks and weeks. They were, actually, the border was an issue for them. One of them didn't, I forget which one, didn't realize that there had to be a border.
I think it was Mary.
Yeah. Oh, Mary McMoney's? Yeah.
Yeah, I think there was supposed to be a border, so I think Mary was playing by the rules.
Oh, but then Mary Cassatt was like, oh, don't worry, it'll be so high up, no one's going to notice. And that's like one thing that...
No, I think Cassatt got actually called did do the right thing. I think she was supposed to have borders.
Oh, she was.
Yeah,
okay.
I think it was McMoney's. Okay. Two Marys were getting confused. But like the concept, which I think is like our overarching point, the concept I am so into. Like, it's really saturated my brain over the past couple weeks that we've been working on this.
Yeah.
This is something like I hadn't ever really thought of until recently because I grew up in a very toxic church. I'm not saying like all churches are toxic. Mm-hmm. My experience was. Mm-hmm. But I went through this process of undoing all of that stuff that had been etched into me as a little boy.
And little husk.
Little boyman husk, yeah. You know, I had to go through the process of giving myself the old 40 grit sandpaper, trying to sand out those VeggieTales and the insiders, you know. And I might have like sanded a little bit too far.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty normal. And like, instead of accepting these as parables for how we've come to conceptualize our existence, I threw out the babies with the orb water. The feminist-minded authors Mary was clued into were more nuanced and were actually questioning why Eve was the villain in the first place. Like, what is so wrong with wanting knowledge?
Right.
With wanting the knowledge of humanity, this thing that you're a part of. And Eve allowed us to taste from that tree of knowledge. All of us.
Yeah.
Eve allowed us to die, and in dying to know all the pain and suffering of life. And it's only in that pain that you actually know what joy is, too. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're just living this, like, bland, perfect, like, suburban existence, which is how I kind of envision the Garden of Eden. You know, without Eve, we don't know fundamentally who we are as humans. We don't know what humanity is.
Right.
And how liberating is it that we can even think about these things, that we can be creative, that we can have divergent thoughts, that we can make connections that aren't necessarily connected, that we can construct our own visual languages. You know, this fear of knowledge, this fear of facing pain, this fear of facing joy, facing anything outside of our confirmed biases and algorithms now, you could argue is like a pretty huge problem for the world today.
Yeah.
I think like 2020 like blew this all up, and we're all kind of just trying to build our own gardens of Eden where we're not forced to like, and I'm not talking about like, you know, terrible ideas that make no sense. I'm talking about like things that maybe challenge us on conceptual levels, that maybe challenge us in the arts, that maybe challenge our sort of like perception of what we like too. Sometimes like not liking something is a good way to learn about liking something.
Right.
You know, you come around on some things, or at least you know why you don't like it. And yeah, I don't know. I feel like we're really stuck in this rut where we are just insulating ourselves.
Well, and we need to give grace to those that make mistakes and, you know, say something that's unpopular or say something that's like wrong or fucked up. And like, we need to give them grace and correct them.
If they're making legitimate mistakes, for sure.
Not hitting cancel immediately.
Yeah.
Because that is part of the labor, correcting someone. That's, I mean, that's labor.
It is a type of labor.
Yeah.
For sure.
You're handing them an apple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, give them an apple.
Yeah, they have a basket.
And accept
give them
apples,
an apple.
Too. That's the other thing. I think we're not accepting apples as well sometimes. So, you know,
what is that?
It goes both ways.
Constructive criticism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We finally watched Evangelion. We've been saying we're going to watch it for a while. I've already seen it, but Stephanie finally watched it.
Yes, I did.
And I guess spoiler alerts for like an anime that's like fucking 30 years old now. The whole plot revolves around returning to this comfort of sameness where you're just like sheltered.
Yeah, it's like a dystopic sort of future, right? Because the world had ended and they were trying to get back to how things were before. No. This was beyond that. They were like, oh, this past was painful. There was like death, there was suffering, and
there's
we want
walls that we put up between.
And now we want none of that. We just want to be all one thing. Then we're just comfortable and warm forever. Mm-hmm. We're just together, and
we all can understand each other. We all like
everything's so harmonious.
We don't have to do the hard work of like getting to know someone.
There's no need to because we're all just one note happy. Sounds yucky.
It is, yeah. That's what it shows. Is that is like not ideal because it's not true humanity. Right. And, you know, I think like that, we need to kind of come back to Eve. Mm-hmm. We need to bite into those wild apples.
Right.
So while I agree with the criticism of this work on a formal level, it still shook me. It's still, I think, super important. And it's doing something right because, like, all of that is being translated through photographs.
Right.
You know,
right.
And a book, too, which isn't, like, the most ideal way to interpret an artwork. But I think, like, if we were just to view the center panel with the title, we would pick up on a lot of that stuff without the sort of literature around it.
That's true. I'm going to go back to Eve real quick. So this whole idea of reframing her is empowering. I don't think I was very aware of that having happened in general. I just don't think I was aware of it. But, you know, having done research on this the past few weeks and I guess even months, we started a while back. But growing up Catholic made me feel really shitty, especially when I was learning about this. And it does not feel great when your teacher's telling you basically your gender is the reason for the fall of humanity. It feels fucked up. And so I was just like, well, this is going in the trash. This is a made up story, clearly. Like, I threw out the apples with the basket. I was like, I don't want to listen to this because like it's clearly a manipulative story to control women. And I was like, no, none of that. So I just totally shut it off. And I'm like, Eve, oh, like that woman in that story that did this, like whatever, throwing it out.
Yeah, throw out the whole story.
Yes, excuse me while I get my second page of notes here, because I have to write it down. Anyway, I think this reframing of Eve is actually more accurate to humanity, because we all make choices, right, for better or for worse, and we should have the freedom to make those choices. And I'm really tired of this narrative, right, of this, like, you know, patriarchal thing, like everyone trying to control our bodies, everything else that's going on. And I want to go back to you saying, oh, this fear of knowledge, like what's so wrong with Eve wanting knowledge? Well, I mean, look how they're defunding schools. I don't want to get too political, but look how everything that requires knowledge is being defunded and it's affecting so many things. And y'all, this is our fight, this generation, like this is our fight. We're having to rebuild what people before us had built because it's getting torn down. And like, we need to sit with it and realize it's not going anywhere.
Right.
Eden is not close, but we need to be harvesting these apples so that future generations can, you know, eat them.
Yeah.
So that's
the fascists, they're trying to make their own Garden of Eden, their own LCL.
That does not exist.
Yeah.
It does not exist. It won't exist because they're...
Really, it's like, it's the wild fruits, it's the wild seeds that, that really, I think, makes society interesting, even if we don't always agree with everybody. It's
dissonance is good. Sometimes, not dissonance,
good.
Diversity is good. So, yeah, I think recognizing what the situation is for us, This is our challenge. This is our 58 by 14 foot mural.
Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, it's weird how like all these artists that we run across, like it's still, I mean, I feel like we say this every single fucking time, but they're still fucking so relevant because we, you know, it's been 100 plus years since this mural was made.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're still dealing with a lot of these concepts, a lot of these issues. And have been for some time. And yeah, it's just really frustrating.
History repeats itself. Humans are predictable, actually.
Yeah, because
they are.
Because we want to, like, we don't want to admit what is, I think, the harsh reality, which is what Eve unveiled. If you want to take that parable to, like, more of a secular interpretation, is like, the world actually is pretty hard out there. And, you know, sometimes it's better not to hide from it. It's better to either embrace it and to work with it and to, you know, construct something that
accounts for the harshness of reality, but also tries to mitigate it as much as possible.
But that starts from questioning rules.
Yeah, you have to know it.
You have to, yes, you have to question why rules are in place. Sometimes there's a reason why there's a law or a warning on something, because something bad happened to somebody and they had to put a warning on a product. Mm-hmm. Like, think about that. But it's good to question things, even if in the end, like, it's there for your safety, for your protection. But, like, question it, right? She questioned it. Why can't I have this apple? Mm-hmm. What is wrong with the snake? Mm-hmm. Didn't God put everything on this earth? Like, why is the snake here?
Why is the knowledge reserved?
Exactly. Question everything. And to question things, though, you have to have the wherewithal. I don't know why that word is with me today, but
you have to have the experience. You have to, you know, experience pain, and you have to experience struggle. And I think Mary, for all her privilege, she did experience that.
She did.
And that's why she was able to speak to it.
You know what I'm saying? This is from...
She had geese pecking at her eyes.
Questioning.
Not literally, but...
Well, maybe. I don't know. I've almost had geese peck out my eyes. No, it's curiosity. And children have this, and we yell at them. Not me, but historically... have told them not to question things, do what I say, but it starts with that curiosity. And honestly, we need to nurture that curiosity. Rein it in, but don't take that away from children, because that is how they grow up to make the world a better place. They make a good point sometimes.
Like, and while she didn't have children herself, she surrounded herself with children. She surrounded herself with laborers for her paintings. So she had a really intimate look at that. And like we said, she struggled a lot herself. She really had to fight for what she wanted to do in life.
She understood the labor of having children and the importance of also nurturing them along with everybody else.
Well, she understood that curiosity. She understood that drive that is innate to humans that we try to shuffle down through societal order.
Right.
And, you know, maybe it didn't go far enough. Like, the suffragettes were good in some ways and bad in some other ways. You know, it didn't extend.
They had a dark side.
Yeah, they had a dark side. It didn't extend to people who weren't white. But, you know, she at least knew a bit of that. And she's trying to show it in these works. And for that, I think it's a success that we're even talking about that.
Which is a lot for a white upper class woman to do in her time.
And it's a lot for somebody in the fucking, what was it, 1890s to conceptualize.
Yeah.
Because this isn't their lived experience. And I'm sure most of the people going to the Chicago's World Fair are a little bit more affluent, a little bit like more connected. So they had that more veal-based life.
Yeah.
So maybe it was pushing some buttons there. You can hope.
And it's funny because she's like, well, I'm not going to be there to see it. I'll send Degas a postcard, though.
Yeah.
I don't know if she ever did. So for me, all of that being said, yes, this is definitely going in the Arts Ice Museum.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Arts Ice Museum, grainy, blown up to scale photograph. I think we rightfully place it in an orchard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe we have some of those trees and bushes and whatever, you know, tastefully obscuring the bookends, so we just have to be the center panel.
That's funny. I like that.
I still don't really get the bookends. It's okay. It's fine. It's fine. It is what it is. What were you going to say?
I like it. I like them. But I understand the more powerful the component is the center panel, for sure.
I also propose that we raid whatever is left of those preserved kind of seed reservoirs, you know?
Oh, right.
The bunkers that I think Doge cut the funding to. Mm-hmm. And we grow some old ass shit, you know?
Yeah.
We see what kind of weird vitamins are in these things, you know?
We'll find out.
Yeah, we'll find out. And that's the point. It's the knowledge.
We'll find out.
If I die, at least I have the knowledge.
Well, right. You had the knowledge for a second before you went. If you enjoyed Mary Cassatt's story, you might want to give our last two episodes on Wanda Gogh and Violeta Parra a listen or watch. Both of their works are from strong women who really rant against the grain, like Mary did here. And please, please, please remember to like and subscribe or leave us a 5-star written review if you can. Pretty, pretty please. And share it with a friend, even if you think that they don't like art. We've been known to convert some non-art people.
It's been known to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've gotten some letters and we appreciate those. So
yes, we do.
We're still like a pretty small show in the grand scheme of things. So yeah, if you share it with more people will find out about us and that helps us out. We really appreciate that.
Sign up for our free newsletter for algorithm-proof alerts to new episodes or pick up a new t-shirt. All of this is at artslicepod.com. And yes, thank you. Your microphone's in the way. Let us know what your favorite depictions of Eve are. And we've finally had some time to release some bonuses on our Patreon at patreon.com/artslicepod.
This is all kind of like a choose your own adventure way of supporting Art Slice. Yeah. So however you choose, we thank you very much.
Yes. We love you. We appreciate you.
We do.
Could not do this without you.
Could not. Absolutely not.
So we will be back in a few weeks with a new episode.
And don't forget, your kid could not have constructed a 58 by 14 foot mural, conceptualized, painted it, facilitated it, organized its shipment to Chicago, only to be displayed for a short time before being destroyed forever.
Bye.
Goodbye.